Welcome back to Fear or Favor. My name's Mark Williams Thomas, and Nazir, of course, is my budding partner here. Nazir, how's your week been?
Mark, I'm just about getting used to coming out of lockdown. I think it's really been a struggle. I think it's more tiring now than I've ever remembered it. We sort of got used to traveling all over the place, you and I, but now when we travel, it's a mission.
I think that's right. I mean, I used to go to town, you know, London 2-3 times a week. And now every time I go, not only am I exhausted when I come back, but it seems such an effort. Whereas before, it would just be routine.
Yeah. I just feel like I have to think things through. You know, used to get up, go. Now, how do I get there? Where do I go? What do I have to do? And when you get there, you know, you have to wonder whether or not you need to wear a mask or don't wear a mask or... How people feel about you being around them. Should you hug them? Should you shake their hands? We're in a very different world now, but I think we've got to get used to it.
So whatever you're doing, for the next hour, we're going to discuss something that means a lot to both of us. Let me just set the scene. 48-year-old Metropolitan Police Officer Wayne Cousins has now been sentenced to a whole life tariff for the murder of Sarah Everard. This has led to a debate around the violence carried out by men against women. Something you've spoken about a lot.
Yeah.
Before we get into covering the details of the case, violence against women is not new. It's been around for a very long time.
I mean, it predates pretty much every other bigotry you can think of. I mean, if you're a person of Abrahamic faith, you know, Christian, Jewish or Muslim, it began in the Garden of Eden. And so the idea that women are some lesser being, that men are more powerful, that women actually have to do exactly what men say, is embedded in cultures across the world. There is no place, I always say, there's no place on earth where there is real equality, where women feel safe. And what we've learned particularly over the last 18 months with the pandemic, is that locking people away at home with their abuser isn't a good thing. Mm. You know, we've had a significant increase in domestic abuse over the last year and a half because women haven't been able to seek help outside of the home. And additionally, the services that would normally be available for them, Mark, have diminished. You know, there weren't enough volunteers. People weren't able to help.
And I think what's really interesting is when you look at the violence against women, you know, I've just done a program around the Yorkshire Ripper and the 1980s misogyny that sits around males within policing, and particularly this attitude, stay at home because you'll get attacked. Whereas, hang on a minute, you know, why do we need to target and say to women to stay at home, when actually what we need to be doing to say to men is women should be able to go out and feel safe?
This comes from government down, doesn't it? We always posit this issue as an issue of women's safety. You know, women, any strategy that begins with the words women must or women should is a failure because it doesn't address the real reason why women must or women should, i.e. there is male violence. And a substantial proportion of our male community, I'm afraid, will turn to violence, to control, to coercive behavior, to murder. And I think we need to start addressing that issue. One of the things that's come out of this particular case that we're going to discuss is that the narrative, I think, is beginning to change. The government initially, their initial view was, you know, more street lighting. Well, all that does, Mark, is show you who's going to attack you, you know?
Yeah.
And the least safe place for a woman is her own home. So that street lighting is not going to help them. So we need to work on what men need to do. And what, you know, there's a lovely diagram I saw where one box where the woman has to, you know, call police, you know, hail a bus, all manner of things when she isn't being harmed. There's another box with a man, just a single man in the middle, just carry on as before. And we've got to change that narrative.
But where have we come to? So, you know, the stuff that I looked at, certainly in relation to Ripper, the 1980s and misogyny within policing, is it, do you think, a problem that we've got so many? I mean, what I found about the 1980s was that the police force in senior ranks was predominantly male. Now, we have addressed that, haven't we? We've addressed a lot of that, certainly within senior policing. I mean, we've got a chief commissioner of Metropolitan Police who's a female, and actually we've got more chief constables now of provincial forces than ever have been before. So we are tackling that, and do you think that's helping?
I think if you talk to the women who were senior police officers. There are former ex-chief constables who've come on the record the last couple of weeks saying, it doesn't, the fact that you have a figurehead that's a woman doesn't change the culture.
Yes.
Cultures are, can be, and you will know as a former cop, you know, any environment, not just a police station, but any environment, any workplace, there'll be misogyny, there'll be sexism, there'll be all the other hatreds and bigotries. The only difference, of course, is the police have the power to use and utilize whatever prejudices they may
have. What concerns me is we don't do enough internally as managers, both middle rank managers and senior managers, to tackle misogyny and tackle those views when they occur. So we allow it to happen. You know, if somebody says something in front of me that I think is inappropriate, I'll challenge it. But I don't always think those challenges are happening.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't happen. I mean, I've lost, I can't begin to imagine the number of friendships or acquaintanceships that I've lost where somebody said something terrible, abusive, bigoted, and I simply said, I challenged them on it and I don't want to know you, or they end up not coming, you know, to see me again because they realize that that's the view I've now formed of them. This is how we do. We always say safeguarding should be everybody's business. It shouldn't be left to police or the authorities to deal with it. Each member of the public has a responsibility. You know, if my neighbor were to hear some abuse or attacks going on next door, they have a responsibility. But unfortunately, you know, and I know, most people for an easy life, that's their view anyway, won't do anything about it. And that culture, the canteen type culture that you just described, is everywhere. But it won't change if we turn a blind eye to it. Mm. And that, sadly, is what's been happening.
So let's look at the Sarah Everard case, and then we can come back and talk a little bit more, I think, in terms of what we can do to try and tackle the attitudes and the views held by males around females. So Wayne Cousins, he's a serving or was a serving Metropolitan Police officer. He has now received a whole life sentence for the kidnap, rape and murder of 33-year-old Sarah Everard. It all starts back in March when Sarah is walking to her friend from her friend's house back to her home address, and she is stopped. She's stopped by Cousins, who at the time is in plain clothes. He says that he's stopping her for breaching COVID guidelines, and he then handcuffs her. As a result of handcuffing, he then puts her into a hire car and he drives her to an area close to where he lives, puts her into his own car. He then takes her to a remote location where he rapes and murders her, strangling her with his police belt. The next day, he decides that he's going to dispose of her body in a more permanent way. He comes back with petrol. He puts her inside a fridge and sets fire to it. He then puts her remains into rubble bags and takes it to a nearby area of woodland and puts her into a pond. It's a week before she is discovered. He's now been sentenced. The judge was very clear that actually he set out that day to attack a young woman, to kidnap and to rape them. His target had not been decided in the morning, but the opportunity when he saw Sarah Everard came about. Let's look in terms of him as an individual. There were a lot of warning signs, weren't there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there was a nickname, the rapist, that other officers used about him. He'd been disciplined or was being disciplined for indecent exposure. The former forces that he used to work with had concerns about him. It appears that very few people did anything at all about what needed to happen, and he was allowed to get more emboldened. This is what happens, Mark. They start quote unquote small, and then it escalates. And unless you intervene early, then I'm afraid it's too late. And clearly, in his case, there were plenty of red flags. So many, quite frankly, that, you know, you have to ask yourself that it must have been cultural as to why nothing was done rather than just incompetence.
How important? I mean, I think that there is a very strong, it's really bizarre because being a police officer, an ex-police officer, I always thought, and the experience of my experience is that police officers, when they're investigated, some are dealt with very harshly. and others are dealt with very poorly. And there just seems to be a lack of consistency that sits around this, because quite clearly he goes into a McDonald's, indecently exposes himself, yet doesn't get dealt with. Why?
It makes no sense. Only recently, a police officer was discharged from the force for underpaying.
Jaffa cakes.
For a Jaffa cake. 90 pence. Underpaying,
yeah.
90 pence for a Jaffa cake. Because that was, quote unquote, dishonesty. And we cannot have dishonest police officers. But we can't have rapists in the police force either. We can't have indecent exposure suspects in the police force either. There seems to be like a hierarchy of crimes or disciplinary matters. And for this, again, is why people are concerned about it being more cultural than anything else, that they simply said, well, boys will be boys in relation to what he did prior to Sarah's murder. When in fact, any research would tell them that had they identified it earlier, dealt with it earlier, Sarah would still be alive.
And isn't that so often the case for so many, you know, tragic situations, incidents that occur, that there are red flags that are highlighted before, but because of the failure to deal with them? I mean, I can remember examples in the police force when something would come to our attention, and it may be fairly minor, but I always used to say, you know, that was our opportunity to start to investigate the individuals. You know, we went through a stage where, you know, go back to the late 90s, when the possession of child abuse material didn't carry a warrant. So you couldn't actually go into someone's house and search for it.
Yeah.
It then became an arrestable offence. And I always used to see that as an opportunity to delve further. So once you've arrested, once you've been to someone's house, searched them, found child abuse material, that gives you the opportunity to really dig into them. And you will, you'll almost always find that those people who commit offences of possessing child abuse material will have some kind of contact offences. There's real clarity and similarity between the two. That's the start of the investigation, isn't it?
Well, I mean, you and I, with our experience, you know, you don't have to have had our experience to realize that some things are entry-level crimes. And the kinds of behaviors you just described, the indecent exposures that we've talked about already, they are entry-level. They're people testing out how far they can go with whatever abusive conduct that they have. And it should, in all cases, be a marker for further investigation. Does it say something about culture? Does it say something about resources? You know, do the police have sufficient expertise or people who are going to carry out disciplinary investigations, for example? You know, back in the day, when there was alleged widespread corruption, you had, you know, large groups of police officers who were seen as, I think Met used to call them ghostbusters. You know, the police were scared of them. They were police officers that police were scared of. Who they knew would be investigating them as and when information came to light. Maybe those don't exist anymore to the same degree. And that's why they're prioritizing what areas of police behavior they investigate.
I do think resources plays into it massively. I mean, I still can't get my head around the fact that, you know, when I was in the police force, that there were down times. It wasn't constantly busy, 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 busy. Now they are constantly having jobs backed up. You can't even get through on 101 to police forces. Now, I know we've lost police numbers, but we have to look at it and go, why is it now we can't cope with the workload? Is it because we take everything and we need to prioritize and we need to look at it? Do we need to have regional and national police forces be able to deal with different things? I think there's a real debate, isn't there, around how do we create policing to be better and more effective?
Do you know, policing has to change because crime has changed. You know, more than half of crime now is online or using digital means. And do we have the police forces and police officers that can deal with that? And also the the needs of justice have changed. You know, we've talked about the 80s and 90s. Before I became a prosecutor, and probably before you became a police officer, Mark, you could have a murder trial in 4 or 5 days.
Yeah.
Because there wasn't the levels of disclosure that there is now. There wasn't the forensic evidence that there is now. There certainly wasn't the digital evidence that there is now. So the burden of producing a case, investigating a case, is more, even if the number of cases stayed the same. And a number of cases are increasing, and the type and variety of cases are increasing. So, and you know, we've talked about the numbers of police officers, but look at the experience. Somebody of your experience, 20 odd years, you know, that's the people who left the police force. They're the most expensive officers. So we lost 21,000 officers with 24 or 25 years of experience. We lost 500,000 years of policing experience. You can't replace that. You can't replace that with 20 officers, 20 out of the police academy.
And it's de-skilling. It's huge de-skilling within the police service. You know, you're losing those skills. I mean, I what I find fascinating, and going back to the Peter Sutcliffe Yorkshire Ripper again, which obviously I've just done a programme on, he was arrested and he was brought to trial within 4 months for the murder of 13 women and the attempted murder of 9. That's 4 months from arrest to trial at the Old Bailey. Yep. Can you imagine that happening now?
No, not in a million years. I mean, in Sarah Everard's case, it was 6 months on a guilty plea. So, you know, had it been a contested matter, the trial wouldn't probably be happening until next year. So it just goes to show. I mean, we believe very much more in fairness and fairness to both sides, etc. So absolutely, the level of attention that you need to give to a case has grown and is necessarily grown, but the resources aren't there to make it happen. So things will fall in the gaps. I'm afraid what happened to Cousins or what didn't happen to Cousins prior to Everard's murder is an example really of that, those gaps.
Why do you think he pleaded?
Well, the evidence was overwhelming, wasn't it? I mean, initially when he was confronted by the police, he suggested, you know, a bit of racism.
Groomed or blackmailed.
Well, worse than that, he suggested Albanian gangs might have been responsible. I've got some Albanian friends who always take offence at them. They're always mentioned when there's some terrible crime. But once the evidence came to light, you know, the various attempts to destroy her body and you know everything else. I mean, the evidence was overwhelming. He knew he was. Not going to succeed at trial. His initial thought, of course, was to look at whether or not there was diminished responsibility or some mental health issues that might mitigate what sentence he gets. But as it happens, no doctor was prepared to sign that off. And so he literally had no choice but to plead guilty. And of course, you know, if generally when you plead guilty, you get a discounted sentence. You know, you get X percentage off. In this case, because he had no choice about pleading guilty, the judge says, well, I would never give you a discounted sentence. And then, by the way, I'm going to give you a whole life sentence anyway.
And there are many, many cases we've both dealt with where the authorities have messed up and they've got it wrong. But it's important when they get it right that we praise them. And I have to say, I think the level of policing, the investigation for this case was phenomenal. You're second to none. You know, they were onto it.
The judge, it's rare for a judge to comment on an investigation, but the judge at the sentencing said, commended the officers, the senior team, and the officers responsible for bringing Cousins to justice, and actually used the words, the best investigation I have seen in 3 decades as a judge. Now, that is worth repeating. The team that brought Cousins to justice, the team that gave Sarah Everard's family some closure, did a phenomenal job, and a thankless job, but a phenomenal job.
And of course, one of the areas that they were very tireless in, which was CCTV and getting hold of footage. And of course, that's changed over years. Now, the external factors, CCTVs, Ring doorbells, all of that lot plays massively into a police investigation.
It does, but as I said earlier on, we don't have the police, don't have the resources. Then there is now. I mean, I remember one case just before I retired as a prosecutor where the individual under suspicion had 84 devices. And it would have taken forever for a digital examination of every single one. So they, you know, they made a judgment as to how many they would actually look at. I think they'll still be looking at it now, 6 years later. So when you mention all the potential ways of digital evidence being obtained in places, it just goes to show what a great job they did in this particular case, but it also shows what a burden policing has to carry going forward. I don't know what the answer is.
And it is a massive problem. I remember senior officers putting a dictate out to paedophile units, basically saying, you know, don't send every computer piece of equipment off to be analyzed because of the cost. So you're having to make a decision. And imagine if you get that decision wrong. You say, well, actually, well, what we'll look at this one, but not this one. But actually, all the stuff's on the other material.
You know, that's the added factor, cost, because forensic sciences, apart from one aspect of it, has been privatized. So when the police are sending it out, they have to think about the bottom line. And actually, they should never have to think about the bottom line, but that's where they are now. And
policing is about cost now, isn't it? Policing, prosecution, absolutely. It's all about cost.
Absolutely. I mean, I it really angers me, to be frank. I mean, I spent, on one case we prosecuted in 2013, I spent, allocated the spending of £4 million to it because it was the right amount of money to spend or what was necessary. It was the money. I didn't care about how much it was. We needed to bring this particular family to justice. Now people would question whether or not that spending was appropriate. Well, you know, is there a price on justice?
But there is. There is. And this is why it's wrong. You know, it's like, is someone's life worth more than somebody else's? You know, how much do we put to one investigation compared to another one?
Well, this links into the issue about misogyny and hatred. You know, do the police have to think, well, actually, there's a woman victim here. Does she get a better service or a lesser service than a male victim? Does a black victim get a lesser or better? They shouldn't be having to make those judgments.
Well, look at the state of misogyny in the 1980s and 90s when we had the Yorkshire Ripper and the prostitutes. You know, that whole view that they weren't as worthy. You know, the massive change when the victim was identified not to be a prostitute out of that serial.
Yeah.
The whole change, the media attitude change, the whole public attitude change, simply because they were saying, we've now got a victim who has not put themselves in a position, you know, they become more worthy. What a terrible way to look at it.
I mean, you're in the 80s, but some people were saying, for example, look how beautiful Sarah Everard is or was, as if somehow that meant that we should deal with this case more seriously than if perhaps she came from had a different lifestyle or she looked different. You know, in the time between Sarah's murder and where we're speaking today, more than 80 other women have been murdered in this country. Do you know the names of any of them?
I know. But isn't that at the heart of some of this? You know, the media agenda that drives some of these things. When we have, you know, I do, as you know, an awful lot of work around missing and abducted and murdered children. And when we have a young child that goes missing, who comes from a middle class or wealthy family, white, but a girl, you know, these things will put you right to the top of the agenda. Whereas if you are a mixed race or black child, a boy coming from a low
income
family, you won't get that same level of attention. You certainly won't get the same media profile.
No. They'll make excuses. That's wrong. 100% is it wrong. They'll make excuses and say, maybe he does run away. Or maybe, has he run away before? So somehow that means that's a marker as to whether they shouldn't take it seriously. It is absolutely, this is what happens. And this is why you need to root out those types of thinking and potentially those people who think that way, because it means that a sizable sector of our society is not going to be treated fairly. And it means that murderers, by the way, and offenders know the groups that the authorities aren't that happy about dealing with or interested in dealing with. And so they actually target them. I found that with Rochdale and the grooming gangs. Those girls were working class, from very poor backgrounds, chaotic, troubled backgrounds. The state didn't want anything to do with them. Guess what? The offenders knew that and targeted them for that reason, because they knew that there'd be no consequences.
And that's the point, isn't it? You know, I've for years now, I've been saying that one element of policing is pretty simple, because actually what we can do is target the most vulnerable with resources, because the most vulnerable are the ones that get targeted by the offenders. So if we look at those that are most vulnerable and we provide policing support and services to those people, you'll reduce the amount of crime that takes place, because we know that they are the target audience.
Yeah, absolutely.
But nobody seems to have really thought about this and actually logged onto it and thought, do you know what? Actually, yes, let's look after the most vulnerable, yeah, because that will naturally reduce crime.
They don't vote, Mark. They don't vote. They don't actually contribute taxes in some cases. So politicians and general authorities take a view that's not my constituency. I don't need to worry about those people. I need to worry about the Marks and Nazirs of this world, because they pay taxes and they whatever it is, that they're somehow they're in a middle class background. They're more important than those young girls or those young boys that are so vulnerable. So I mean that's the nub of it. But the other major point is that the offenders don't stick to working class victims, or these young victims who are so vulnerable, as you described. They'll move on. So if we intervened early to protect these really vulnerable people and got the offenders really early, everybody's safe.
Yes. It's mad, isn't it? Just to help our friends across the seas in America and so on, whole life tariff. Now, people in America will go to jail, and they'll go to jail for life. Mm. But in the UK, that doesn't happen very often. Just set that out. No. Obviously, as a prosecutor,
We got rid of capital punishment in the mid-60s. So we've had no capital punishment for 50-odd years. I was shocked to learn that the French were still guillotining people in 1977. But anyway, we got rid of capital punishment 50-odd years ago. And then we thought, well, actually, there's a group of people that are never, ever, they've committed either something so heinous, something so terrible, or they are such going to remain a risk forever that there ought to be something in place to make that happen. So the judges were given this power a few years ago to issue what they call whole life tariffs. And what that means in simple terms is that you will leave prison in a coffin. Yeah. And there are 60 or so people in British jails, in the 85,000 British prisoners that we have, 60 or so that have whole life tariffs. So one that I dealt with was Dale Cregan, who murdered two Manchester police officers and two other organized criminals. So he killed four people and two officers, female officers. He will never leave prison. And the decision was taken that it should be reserved for the most heinous offenses. And obviously the judge took a view that a police officer, a serving police officer, using the tools of policing to kidnap and rape and murder Sarah Everard damaged trust in policing so much that a whole life tariff was appropriate.
And in terms of Cousins now, he's never going to get out.
No.
He's in jail forever. But let's look in, what is it, when you go back to looking at the why males grow up with some of these attitudes that they have. We've talked a lot around violence and video games, the easy accessibility now of porn online, the breaking down of those barriers around that. And I think all of that does have an impact, because what we know about children is that they are a blank canvas. Yep. And what they grow up with and their environment around them does influence their later life.
Well, you're born to hate nothing, maybe broccoli, but apart from that, you're born to hate nothing. And so you learn hatred. So you learn to hate minorities or black people or gay people or women. So this is learned behavior and therefore needs to be addressed as early as possible in school. But it is so embedded in our society. You know, until recently, a few years ago, one of our national newspapers had a topless woman on page 3, you know?
Yes. And
we had television programs day in, day out, where jokes were
well, you know, Benny Hill.
Popular, very popular in America still, and worse than that, where simply women were treated with disdain, yeah, where the joke was look, it's a woman. And when you get that happening, Mark, and it's so embedded in our culture, it is going to impact in other ways and in more nefarious ways, that somehow women are lesser beings, that somehow men can control what they do, where they go. And that means that, give you some figures. Two women every week in this country, in the UK, are killed in domestic abuse situations. 10 women kill themselves every week because of domestic abuse. 10 every week. One in four women in this country suffer domestic abuse. One in five are sexually assaulted. 97% of women told a survey earlier this year that they have suffered sexual harassment at least once in the last year. That is how deep and embedded it is in our society. And is it no wonder that some people go further than sexual harassment and end up being physically abusive and ultimately homicidal or committing femicide? And violence against women, Mark, is the largest risk to women's health, larger than blood pressure, larger than obesity, larger than COVID. It is the pandemic that will outlive this pandemic. And unless we respond to it as we should respond to a pandemic, i.e. with, tackling every element of it, not just you and I have spent a career in criminal justice and police investigation. That's the end game. By the time they get to us, they've already been harmed. The work that needs to happen is earlier in addressing inequality, in addressing misogyny, in addressing...
Do you think we do enough in schools then? Because actually the heart of this problem is... Just as simply as you said, it's children aren't born with preconceived ideas.
No, we don't do enough in schools. We don't
at all.
No, there is. I mean, there's citizenship classes. There is more in high school. There's something called relationship and sexuality education, but that's not mandatory. And the reason why it isn't is because there are some vested interests who do not want their children taught about things like gay people exist. Women's rights, equality, for whatever reason, because of their faith or their belief systems, they don't want it taught in school, and in fact they're very often taking them out of school if that's going to happen. So what the government state needs to do is you're Welsh, are you? And I'm national advisor to the Welsh government. The Welsh have mandated it now in schools from September. Don't care what families think and the communities think. Well, we do care. We've listened to you, but we've ignored. We're going to ignore you, and we're going to make it mandatory now. That's the only approach. If you make it happen, then yes, you can have proper conversations about it.
So, do you see the future changing? I mean, we have moved a long way. I think we have to acknowledge that we have moved a long way since the 80s and 90s, but we've still obviously got a long way to go in terms of those attitudes. And also, I don't think we can ignore the power, the physical power difference between men and women.
Absolutely. I mean, there are some women that could knock me out in a second. So I don't think that we should look at that. And you will know from your own experience that I've often dealt with murderers who literally, I thought, he couldn't possibly murder a fly, So physical strength had nothing to do with their mental capacity to kill and harm.
It's the ability to overpower, though, isn't it? It's the ability
to control. And to manipulate. This is the thing. When, as a parent, I know what buttons I've put in my children. You know, from day one, you put certain buttons in, certain things that will create a reaction of some kind. Controlling men do that. They know what buttons to press. They press them. They hold all the cards, and some of them then lead to violence. And that's why a justice response is inadequate and insufficient. And it has to be a whole system approach.
And I think one of the other elements around that whole attitude towards violence against women is the failing to kind of acknowledge that the most dangerous place for a woman is within the confines of their own environment, their home. And actually, those people in the UK who are fans of Coronation Street, and I have to say that I do follow Coronation Street. I don't know if you do as a man.
Now and again,
yeah. Manchester. Now and again. Obviously, they had that very strong storyline, didn't they, with regards to the ghost ghosting of the, the lady in there. And actually, it starts so subtly. And actually, to many people outside, they may not see it. But that controlling behavior wears you down, wears you down, wears you down.
Yeah.
But it is, and ultimately results in the serious total harm. And utter serious harm. Yeah, that power imbalance massively.
It does. And when you see it fictionalized or dramatized in television or TV, you think, well, why didn't anybody else notice? Well, you know, because we close our eyes. You know, in the road that I'm living in, the road you're living in, if the figures, and the figures are correct, one in four will be suffering abuse. So you walk down the road, every four or five homes, there's an abusive relationship.
Yeah.
Just get that into your head. That's, so if you, if that's the situation, then it requires everybody taking responsibility for this. And, you know, I pay tribute to, never mind the police officers, I pay tribute to the school teachers who notice a child, for example, that might be subdued, depressed about what's happening at home, because very often they'll refer and therefore protect. I pay tribute to the grocer, the neighbor, all of whom who suddenly think, I need to do something about what I've heard and what I've, but we all need to be thinking that way and we all need to be acting that way because at the end of the day, we're all impacted. You know, the figure that always gets me, by the way, it's a UK figure. The cost of domestic abuse, according to the UK Home Office, is £66 billion a year. That's justice costs, loss of taxes, loss of welfare, health costs, social security costs, childcare, you name it, £66 billion. That's twice our defense budget. So we you know, there's never mind the legal case, the ethical case, the moral case. Here's the business case that we can actually have more funds as a society to spend on the things that matter if we tackle this issue.
And I think as a society, we need to do more. You know, I talked about ghosting, you know, that gaslighting effect that women suffer from their partners at home. And I think we as a society have to do more to acknowledge that, to pass on those concerns, to talk to people, to ask them those questions. You know, if you see somebody and they, you know, they're being put down the whole time by their partner, or you see somebody and they've got injuries or something, you know, spend that time, take them to one side and just talk to them. You know, they may just be, and I say this so often, is that very often as a police officer, that initial cry for help might be something really minor. It might be something that's got absolutely nothing to do with the main issue that's going on.
Yeah.
But we have to look at it, stand back for it and go, okay, why is it that that's happened? You know, what is it that's causing around? And particularly in the world of child protection, you know, sometimes a child perhaps might appear having, you know, constantly wetting themselves or some situation that's occurring. You know, slightly aggressive behavior, perhaps within school. And what we have to do is look at that and go, well, what is the cause of that? What is that a side effect of something else going on? And I think as we've talked about it a lot, haven't we, around mental health, saying, you know, give people the time. But let's transfer that into how we look after people around us, those women at home, you know, look after each other.
No, after one of my cases, I did a town hall meeting and I said, look, it's beggar's belief that nobody knew what was going on and nobody did anything about it. And somebody stood up and said, well, do you want us all to be snitches? Do you want us all to be grasses? I said, no, I want us all to be a nation of good neighbors. You know, look out for each other. That could be your child, your wife, your partner, etc. And you made the point a moment ago about, you know, asking the right questions, but you don't have to ask. The skill that I would really value more than anything else is listening.
Yeah, yeah.
Because often it's the unsaid that tells you what's going on and what's not going on. So, for example, if my wife was saying this to me about one of her ex-friends, was that she never had any money on her. And at one point she said, well, you know, my husband gives me £10 a week, whatever it was, you know. You know what's going on there.
Yeah.
You know?
Control.
Then you think, well, where is that going and what do I do with that information? Well, the great news is even if you don't go to the police because you don't think yet it's that serious, there are lots of NGOs, lots of charities, lots of organizations that are there to provide support for somebody like that. And you need to be able to tap into those organizations.
Yeah, we are rubbish at listening, aren't we? I mean, I always use the analogy is that the most people who you just want to tell something to and listen, most of the time they impart their views back to you.
Yeah,
like, I don't want to know that. I just want you to listen. I don't need you to talk to me and tell me what you think I should do about it. I just want you to listen to me.
And the escalation, you know, it starts with, he only gets me half £10 a week to ultimately leads to femicide. And people need to realize that if you had stepped in, there's no point saying when she's being buried and the trial's taking place, well, you know, I learned something or I knew something. It's too late then, isn't it? We're very, I don't know if it's a British thing or a worldwide thing, but, you know, we tend to keep ourselves to ourselves. It's not my business. Remind me again, it's everybody's business. Yeah. And we will keep safe if we keep safe together.
And one of the things that really grabs my goat and it makes me so angry is when that somebody comes out afterwards in senior positions and says, lessons to be learned.
Yeah. Ashamed. The commissioner of the Met said, I'm ashamed at what happened when one of her officers murders somebody. And of course, the other ridiculous thing is that he was dismissed from the force after his guilty plea. So it was 6 months whilst he was waiting to be dismissed. It just looks, doesn't it? It just looks really bad.
And I think paid as well, wasn't he? Paid for that period of time.
Exactly. So what does it say? Being ashamed, learning lessons. Well, they never learn any lessons, Mark.
No. Well, we go full circle, don't we? We go full circle. How many children have died and how many you know, serious case reviews have happened and said, we must learn the lessons, you know, and another child dies, you know, and people are dying. And we've just got to. I mean, I think one of the hearts of this problem is that as a society, we have to take more responsibility. We have to address some of these issues really head on. And we have to say, come on, this is what we need to do. But we need a multi-layered approach to this. We need to look at those issues. And in fact, in our next podcast, we're going to look at some of those issues, aren't we, around the PREVENT program, around terrorism, and how that needs to be a coordinated approach.
Well, the link with this is clear. I mean, men radicalize other men when it comes to misogyny. You know, if I was to say something really nasty about a woman, and there was another man next to me and heard that, some of them will think, oh, actually, I can do the same thing. Radicalization happens in gender abuse as it happens in extremism and terrorism. And I often call violence against women gender terrorism because it's completely the same thing. And as we'll discuss shortly, it's really important for people to understand that you have an opportunity to intervene. If you take it, you save people's lives.
What do you think? Let's look at the heart of this. So, you know, you and I are both problem solvers. That's our, you know, we like to approach a problem and see some of those solutions and some of those options that we can do. How are we going to tackle this problem of violence against women?
Well, it starts, as we said earlier on, it starts in education. So mandatory education in school from kindergarten. No, high school's too late. By that time, people have formed their views. So you talk about equalities, you talk about all the responsibilities you have, you talk about what a good relationship is, all of that from as early as possible in an age-appropriate way. That's the first thing. The second thing is that men need to do something different. There's a website called whatcanido.org.uk, and there are many others like that, which is for men. Men have asked me, what can I do? I'm walking behind a woman in the street, and I don't know whether she's scared or not. You know, what do I do? So you need to educate yourself as a man as to what you think you can do to make women around you feel more safe than you have. Thirdly, you need to be a male ally. In the UK, there's something called the White Ribbon Campaign, which happens every November. And you wear a white ribbon. As a man, you're an ally for women who are fighting abuse. And you show that you're an ally. You don't just do it 1 month a year. You do it all throughout the year. Then we talked earlier on about challenge. Mark, you know, you challenge people around you when you hear misogyny and hatred and sexism. You make them abundantly aware that it's unacceptable that they behave that way. And then there's a broader issue, which is about what the state can do. The state needs to, prosecution, the police, and the investigators need to prioritize that. This is still stinks, quite frankly. The violence against women is not a statutory policing requirement. So at the moment, if it's terrorism, that's a statutory policing requirement. If it's serious fraud, if it's serious organized crime, if it's child sexual abuse, then it's a statutory requirement. What that means is the police everywhere have to resource it. But violence against women isn't one. So there's a real pull right now to force the government to make violence against women a statutory policing requirement. That will mean that everybody will resource it rather than just being left to local devices. So it's a multi-layered strategy. The reality is that we know what it is. Much of it requires funding, but it's more than anything else, it requires leadership. And I don't know, a lot of people have said to me that Sarah Everard's murder has changed the landscape and changed people's thinking. Not yet enough, I'm afraid.
But does it really? I mean, we say this, we say some of these things, you know, we've got to change. And actually, what's being done to change that? Because I've heard some of the comments made by politicians and senior police officers. We have to improve lighting. We have to, you know, stop women going out late at night. We have to give them an escort back from a club. We have to do this. It's like, hang on a minute. That is really doesn't tackle the problem. That is just, that's ludicrous suggestions. And I hear some of these and I think, do you have any common sense and think about what you're saying before you say it?
No, women must, women should. It's the same old, and you know, in recent days we've been hearing about drugs spiking, where drinks being spiked. We've heard about some women being injected with drugs in university towns, and you know, the response again is, don't let your drink be spiked. Don't get spiked. Yeah. Don't. Why? You know, we're starting with the victim when we should start with the perpetrator, which unfortunately are men. And, you know, there's nothing that this will not stop if all we want to focus on is how women should make themselves safe, when in fact it's men that can make them safe.
I think something that was interesting, certainly during my policing time, is in the early days of policing, we'd go to domestics. So that's incidents that occur in a family house between cohabiting individuals. And we would often walk away knowing that something had happened. Unless there was any criminal offence, we couldn't. And even then, sometimes that was hard pushed if the individual concerned didn't want to make a complaint.
Yeah.
Then, of course, things changed. And there was a new approach that was adopted as a zero tolerance to domestic violence.
And victimless prosecutions.
Which was a really positive attitude, wasn't it? And actually, that has helped.
It did. And again, you know, I hate to keep coming back to it. When you get rid of specialist teams, as they have done over the last 4 or 5 years, we've gone backwards. But up until 2016, only 5 years ago, Mark, we had the highest conviction rate for violence against women in our history. We had the highest rape conviction rate in our history. So we know what works. We just need to bring it back and put it in place everywhere and resource it properly. Otherwise, I'm afraid we'll make very little progress.
Yeah. Well, that's another interesting podcast. I think we've talked quite extensively around the very sad case of Sarah Everard and, of course, how that significantly leads into women's violence. Still a long way to go, a long, long way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. But we'll make this progress. Let's keep talking about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's keep it on that public agenda. And I think as parents, we have a responsibility very much to talk to our children and to make sure that they are educated so that they see the balance between, you know, whoever you are, whatever you come from, whatever gender you are, whatever your ethnicity, we are one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Brilliant. Well, thank you for listening to Fear or Favour. Next week, we're going to talk around the issues of terrorism. They are never far from the news, both in the UK and worldwide. And I think one of the aspects that I'd like to talk a little bit about is the elements of the risk on the mainland here, but also what plays into that around the, obviously, withdrawal of troops now. Which has had a huge impact potentially on future terrorism. And we know that the security services here have certainly raised some of those concerns. And your experience around this area is far bigger than mine.
Yeah, absolutely. Foreign wars have an impact. International relations have an impact. But it always, as we've just discussed, I'm afraid, starts at home. So let's have that conversation.
Brilliant. Well, whatever you're doing this week, look after yourselves, and we will see you next week. Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kayes, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.